We travel the state for an arts roundup. From SDPB, today is Friday, October 24th. This is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, we begin with a statewide organization, the South Dakota Symphony Orchestra. Maestro Delta David Geyer joins us for a season preview. From the Lakota Music Project to a family-friendly concert, we'll showcase some highlights as we consider why an orchestra matters as a cultural institution. Then Marty Tubbles Jr. joins us to talk about an exhibit of contemporary Lakota art at the Journey Museum in Rapid City. And later in the hour, artist Aaron Castle joins us for a look at food, fair trade, and farmers. How can art help community consider where our food comes from? We're broadcasting today from SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the moment. News is first. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. The South Dakota Symphony Orchestra's newest season opened this month. We're going to get a taste of the upcoming performances. Maestro Delta David Geyer is music director and conductor for the orchestra. He stepped into SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. Maestro Delta David Geyer, welcome back to the In the Moment studios.
Thank you.
It is a new season for the South Dakota Symphony Orchestra, which is something of an event across the state.
Yeah.
What are some of the highlights that you've already navigated? Because you came out of the gate pretty strong.
Yeah, well, the first program was very exciting. It was, you know, focused on Spain, but this ballet, Three-Cornered Hat, by the Spanish composer De Falla, with the super titles and telling the story and everything, and boy, the audience just really, really ate that up. One audience, long-time audience member came up to me afterwards, and she said, well, that's about as much fun as you can have with your clothes on.
You don't hear that often at the symphony. Maybe you hear it every performance.
Yeah. And then we just went into a week-long Lakota Music Project tour.
Yeah.
Which culminated in here in Sioux Falls. We started at Crazy Horse last Monday and came across the state. We hit Pine Ridge and Rosebud and Chamberlain and Wagner and ended in Sioux Falls. And then recorded the two new compositions that we'd commissioned for this.
And
it's just a great week.
Yeah, who are the composers? For people who have the previous recording, they have the full CD and recording of that. Now they're looking at what's new.
Well, one of them is by Jeffrey Paul, our principal oboist, and it's a more substantial piece than The Wind on Clear Lake that he composed that's on that first CD. Another collaboration with cedar flutist Brian Akipa called Songbird and Goose. Mm. And then Derek Bermel, who's a Brooklyn-based composer, and I've known Derek for 30 years. And I've wanted him to work with this project for a very long time because his specialty is going into different cultures and, you know, spending a year, you know, really immersing himself in the music and language culture of a particular place. He did it in Ghana. He's done it in Bulgaria, just on and on. And I knew that he would really invest himself in this project, which he did. He's been here 4 or 5 times over the last couple of years, working with the Creekside Singers from Pine Ridge. And just everybody felt honored by it, which is the main, because it was basically co-composed with Emmanuel Blackbear, the keeper of the drum from the Creekside Singers. And it sort of typifies the Lakota Music Project, because what makes it unique, that project, is that we built it together with our native partners rather than just trotting out a program that we thought would be good for them to hear.
Yeah. Which also means some old friends get together and travel together and catch up.
Yeah. We always joke when we're out on the road with Emmanuel and I in particular. It's like, yeah, we slept in bad hotels, eating bad food together. We're friends. We're not by now. <You know?
laughs> And before you walked in the studio, somebody was telling you how much they enjoyed the performance. So what does it mean, the Lakota Music Project performances, for the community of South Dakota as well?
Well, it's doing what it was designed to do, which is to, you know, whether you're a a white person, a native person, somewhere in between, to come out with a fuller understanding of our shared heritage. And mm-hmm. we used to talk about Lakota Music Project in terms of addressing racial prejudice, and now we just talk about it as a demonstration of friendship.
Yeah. Also, Giants in the Earth, recorded by SDPB. The full opera has premiered now on television. By the time people hear our conversation, yeah. they'll have been able to see it on our YouTube channel and broadcast TV, a documentary about Giants in the Earth, with you explaining how you brought the opera to the stage. You get a lot of feedback, almost yeah. to the point where we're like, okay, enough already.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. We got to see it at the State Theater. What do you think of the opera on screen after staging it yourself?
You know, it's... I was a little concerned about what it would look like on a big screen because, I sat with Kevin Patton for several days, you know,
STPB
looking at
the producer,
little video monitors and, you know, seeing it. So, but it translated, I thought it translated well.
Yeah.
And the sound system was good, so you really got to hear the orchestra and the voices. And yeah, I'm pretty proud of the production.
Yeah, and an important note that you mentioned at the State Theater gathering was that even though you can see in the close-up camera shots of the performers' microphones, because we were recording it for an audio production, they were projecting to the audience. They're real opera singers. Help me understand why they wanted people to know that they weren't mic'd.
Yeah, because you can actually see these little mics, you know, on their faces or whatever it could be with the close-up shots, and those are only there for recording purposes. Yeah, people might have thought that it was amplified, but it was not amplified.
It's not
at
amplified
all.
Into right. the hall. Yeah, no. Other people from across the country, other music directors, other maestros, reaching out to you about that project.
No, not yet.
Not yet.
Actually, yeah. I think the most interest we've gotten is from Norway.
Well, that's not too big of a surprise, right?
Yeah, yeah, right.
But it's early.
It is. I mean, until it gets out there,
yeah.
The it'll it's out there now in video production for people to see, but the commercial recording won't come out until July of next year.
Sure.
So once it's out there, people can assess it and consider it.
Yeah. Do you think it was a success on the stage?
I do. Yeah.
Yeah.
I do. It'd be interesting to see what a fully staged production would be like with putting an orchestra in the pit.
In the pit, yeah.
You know, but once you do that, you got to fill the stage with a set. So
then you have to build the set and have the money to build the set and everything. Yeah.
Yeah.
Tell me what's up next for the South Dakota Symphony Orchestra. What do you want to highlight?
Well, our next program is all about the influence of jazz on classical composers. Some jazz composers, I mean, there's Duke Ellington, there's Chick Corea on that program, but, you know, George Gershwin and some others too. So that'll be a very fun program.
And New York Philharmonic principal trombonist.
Yes, Joseph Alessi, that's
nice.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, Joe and I worked together for years at the New York Philharmonic. He's been here before. You know, many years ago. I love working with Joe and he commissioned this work from Chick Corea. And Chick was a formidable influence on me as a youngster.
Really? How so?
Well, I was classically trained from a very early age, and then I took a detour, shall we say, into Led Zeppelin land and progressive rock, and my way back was through what was known in the 70s as jazz fusion.
Okay.
So Chick Corea was right at the forefront of that, Weather Report, several other, you know, big names. And when Joe told me he was going to commission Chick to write this piece, it's like, wow, I've got to do that. It's cool.
How did that detour, as you called it, influence you as a music director of a classical orchestra in South Dakota? I mean, like, does it show up in ways for you other than like being excited, you know, to bring the music to South Dakotans today? Yeah. Are there other ways that you think it's like, oh yeah, that still influences me?
Well, you know, I guess playing Jimmy Page licks for all those years, and, you know, it gets you out of your box, gets you, you know, get out of what I would say is like a perfectionist box that we are okay. as classical musicians.
Yeah.
you know, and take some of the fear away and a little more raw emotion.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I can sense that, but that jazz fusion was like it's such a natural bridge to like Stravinsky, you know, and Shostakovich, and those early 20th century composers, so colorful, so rhythmically intense. You know, it was not a difficult bridge to make.
What about the intersection with the musician? You know, when I think of jazz and improvisation and the language that, you know, jazz musicians have, how much they understand music, and then how they communicate it with each other. Is there a way to bring that into the orchestra? Is it already there?
Generally not, no. I mean, it's interesting because if you look at the history of the art form back in the Baroque era, there was, a lot of improvisation. It was more like jazz.
Really?
Yeah. The melodies you see, and particularly the early Baroque, are more like a jazz lead sheet, you know, and you were expected to embellish all over the place.
I did not know that.
Yeah. And even singing, like we do Handel Messiah every year, and the singers are expected to come with a certain amount of embellishment, too, and it can be quite unique, you know, but that's the Baroque era. And you get to the classical era, so when we're talking, you know, 1750 into 1800, and like composers like Mozart, where they were improvising their own cadenzas and the piano concertos, you know, like it was expected.
So how is that done now?
They're written. There are people who've written them. I mean, yeah. Mozart actually wrote some down himself. And
so for Bach or something like that, it's all been written down at this point.
Yeah. Well, there are several. Yeah, there's several options out there. You know, whether you can judge whether they're any good or not.
Okay. So that's where some of the criticism comes if someone doesn't like this artist's Bach cello concertos, but they prefer this one.
Yeah.
It would probably have to do with embellishments?
Yes.
I'm asking. I don't know.
Yeah, sure. There's in that sense, there's more to interpret in Baroque than there is in later music, because as our art form progressed, the composers became more and more particular in the way that they notated things. Like in a Mahler symphony, it's not that there's nothing to interpret, but there's a lot there that he tells you exactly what he wants.
Yeah, he's not asking for your help.
Right.
All right.
Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about Peter and the Wolf and some of the family programming you have.
Well,
of course, a lot of us grew up with this.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, I had an album that we'd put on the little, put the needle on the vinyl and listen to it as kids.
Yeah. Honestly, it's hard to beat that Prokofiev piece, Peter and the Wolf. It's magnificent music and a wonderful story. And, it's hard to think of anybody who's, many composers have tried to equal that, but I can't think of any that have actually come up to that point. So we pull it out every couple, 3 years and play it for young people's concerts, for school kids, or in a family concert, because it's just a great way to introduce kids to the orchestra.
Yeah, that's not until spring, but heads up for people who are looking at the season in fall and getting their season tickets still. You've still got time to do that.
Yeah.
Have you ever done Lemony Snicket's The Composer is Dead? You ever looked at that?
Yeah, I've seen it. I mean, that kind of falls in the category of edutainment.
Okay, yeah.
To me, Prokofiev's a great composer.
Right. There's a big difference between the two pieces.
It is. It's somebody who writes a piece of music to tell the story.
Yeah.
That the music becomes a vehicle for the story.
Right.
Rather than the story.
Because it's a picture book that they compose the music for the picture
book.
Yeah.
Exactly.
The center is the book.
Yeah. So we, mm-hmm. I mean, I did all this young people's concert at the New York Philharmonic for years. And edutainment was anathema for us, we just don't do that.
Don't touch it.
Let the music speak for itself.
Yeah.
You don't give them a huge, 70-minute symphony to listen to, but, we give it to them in more bite-sized chunks.
Respecting the music and the kids and the families.
Right.
Being able, not talking, public television, not going down to an audience, but respecting them.
Exactly.
Yeah. All right, holiday programming. People want to get involved in that right now?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, we've got Handel's Messiah.
They've got the Tis the Season is the...
Tis the Season. That's why I couldn't remember what that's been changed.
It's something else. It's had several permutations, No, it's a lot of, you know, I hear it every year for both of those programs. You know, well, it wouldn't be Christmas without Messiah.
Sure.
You know, this is the beginning of our Christmas, and I hear the same thing about Tis the Season. It's like, we wouldn't miss this for the world. This is the beginning of our Christmas.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
New musicians coming in to the orchestra? Any retirements? Any personnel changes that you think are noteworthy?
Our principal violist, Yi-Chun Lin, is on a leave of absence. And Joanna Galu, who's in our first violin section, has stepped in for her. But we miss her. We can't wait to get her back.
Yeah.
We've hired some ancillary people as well, second clarinet and so on, second trumpet. But the big one, which is not yet to be announced, is a new assistant conductor.
Oh, sure. Okay.
Which we had auditions just about 3 weeks ago.
Yeah, yeah. How's the youth orchestra program?
It's good. It's very good. Yeah. This fall, we're filling in that assistant conductor position in various ways. We have Mario Chiarello, who just retired as orchestra director at Lincoln High School.
Oh, did he? Okay.
Yeah. So he's doing the youth orchestra.
Okay.
Thomas Fortner is here right now for the whole month. He covered for me for our opening concert. He went on the Lakota Music Project tour, and he's conducting Psycho this weekend. So that's right up his alley. Nicholas Sharma, who was...
you better say more about why Psycho is up. Thomas Fortner.
Let that be.
Okay, fill the blanks. he'll be calling.
All in good fun. All in good fun. Nicholas Sharma, who was our last assistant conductor, for only 1 year because he got stolen away from us by Toronto Symphony. I'm very happy for him. But he's coming back to do Tis the Season.
Okay.
Yeah. So we filled in like that. But we expect our new assistant conductor to start in January.
Yeah. So what are you excited about in the future as well, the next direction of the orchestra? It seems like you've had such big projects that you've been working on.
Yeah.
Is this a year to sit back and enjoy the great combination that the orchestra brings to the community all the time, or are you hatching something enormous? Are you always doing something
always,
enormous?
Always scheming, yes, for sure. This last year has been such a big success.
Yeah.
And such great national attention. So there's certainly no sense of sitting on our laurels. Actually, the main question I get from everybody is what's next?
Yeah.
The next big project. And there are several candidates for that. But, I mean, the programming gets more sophisticated, bigger every season as we go. Like, we're just putting finishing touches on 2026-27 right now.
Sure, yeah.
And it's a very, very exciting stuff coming up. Joseph Horowitz is really in the mix with us. Like he's doing Shostakovich 8th Symphony with us this season, looking at next seasons. Just had a meeting with four different universities about how we can, all collaborate to bring Joe in and because Joe's NEH funding got cut.
Oh, sure.
Like his program, the Music Unwound program, is totally gone now. Doge just came in and cut the whole thing. So now we got to do it ourselves, and I guess that's what they're after is get us all to do it ourselves anyway. So, that's.
I'm sorry to hear that. That was a great program.
Well, it was a great program, and it was national. Did a lot, but we're going to battle forward. But we need partnerships with the universities, and funding. It all comes down to funding.
Funding. So when people say what next, is it an excitement or is it a what have you done for me lately?
No, I never get that.
Okay.
No. It's always
it's
like you guys are doing really great stuff and we want to see more. So that's it.
That is Maestro Delta David Geyer. He is music director and conductor of the South Dakota Symphony Orchestra. Up next, Marty Tubbles Jr. talks about contemporary Lakota art. We'll get a look into a new exhibition in the Black Hills after a break. You're on Listener Supported SDPB. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Marty Two Bulls Jr. is Artist Laureate of the Oglala Sioux Tribe. He's also curator of Lakota Contemporary, an intergenerational survey of contemporary Lakota art at the Journey Museum. He joined me from SDPB's Black Hills Surgical Hospital studio in Rapid City.
Essentially, the curator picks out the artists and the artwork that are going to go in the exhibition, as well as kind of manages the logistics involved. So the space, getting the artwork there, getting artists paid, getting art on the wall, getting the marketing together, you know, kind of all that stuff.
So do you have a vision going in on what you want this to be? Because it's a survey, which is, you know, there's certain expectations with that and the definitiveness of that. How do you approach it?
Yeah, you know, I started out, I knew I wanted something flexible. Mm-hmm. I wanted to see a diversity of work from my community. And, you know, I was in that kind of position where I wish I had more space. I wish I had more money. You know, I was only able to include a fraction of the artists that are out there in my community. But yeah, I think the vision really started with wanting to see something a little different.
Yeah. Different for the viewer, different for the space, different for the artists involved.
All of the above.
Yeah. Yeah.
I really wanted to do something that allowed for flexibility for the artists involved to express themselves in a way that maybe seemed a little more genuine or kind of honest to what's going on in their studios today, rather than meeting expectations that are placed upon them by outside, you know, curators or critics or academics.
So rather than picking a theme, for example, and saying we're going to have an exhibit about the Black Hills, or we're going to have an exhibit about, you know, this period of time, is that what you mean by flexibility, or is there more to it than that?
Oh, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. What kind of response did you get from Lakota artists? What were they telling you that they wanted to showcase?
Well, a lot of folks were excited because for a lot of the folks, it was the first time they were able to show certain pieces of artwork. Mm. There may have been pieces that they had finished a while ago and had been sitting on, or maybe had shown somewhere else kind of further away, but really hadn't had an opportunity to bring it to Rapid City. So there was a lot of excitement and eagerness.
Yeah. As you looked through some of the submissions or opportunities to look at how you would put everything together, did you notice thematic things that are happening right now? When we look at this word contemporary, it's a broad word, but also like at this point in time, people are showing up in their art in certain ways. What did you observe at first?
So at first, I think a lot of the things that I noticed were the innovation in the work. Mm. This exhibition spans multiple generations. So we have artists like Martin Redbear, who's an elder artist. We have some mid-career artists like Keith Bravehart and myself. And then some younger artists who, this was kind of their first exhibition.
Yeah.
And between that spread, we're talking about like a, you know, maybe a 40, 50-year spread of art making. And if you look at the work, you know, it ranges from acrylic and into, you know, digital art making. And the innovation in materials was really one of the through lines that I'd noticed in a lot of the work, as well as, you know, geometric abstraction, figurative work that explored both sort of historical figures or imagery, but also embraced, you know, contemporary lifestyles and life ways.
So when we talk about innovation in materials and innovation in methods of art making, that strikes me, and you have way more experience in this than I do, of course, but that strikes me as sort of really essential. When I think of Lakota art, I think of innovation. I think of different materials coming in and out of the art making process. What am I picking up on there, and expand on that from your scholarship, if you would, please?
Yeah, definitely. So, you know, oftentimes people talk about Lakota artwork in the terms of like traditional, like what is traditional. And that always kind of bugs me because that standard changes on depending on who you talk to and which generation you're thinking about. Yeah. You know, what I might consider traditional today wouldn't have been something maybe my grandfather or my great-grandparents would have considered traditional, and kind of so on and so forth. There tends to be too much of an emphasis on like a point of purity. Mm. Like we were traditional, you know, pre-contact, or we were traditional, you know, when the horse arrived, or we were traditional when glass beads were introduced into our communities. For me and from my studies and my perspective, I really see the only, not, you know, one of the main parts of our traditions is that innovation. Whenever my people came across a new idea or a new art-making method or a new tool or a new material, oftentimes they were quick to adapt and incorporate that into their art-making and into their cultural practices. You know, you see that with beadwork, you see that with ledger paper, and it's something that's still happening today. You can see it in the work in this exhibition. There are young people who are using iPads and programs like Photoshop to create their artwork.
Where are people learning from? When you talk about the intergenerations, are the older generations learning in official, you know, classroom kind of settings? Are people learning from other generations? Where do you see the development and the education coming from right now?
It's a mixture. You know, a lot of it is sort of learning from your family and your friends and in your community. Some of it happens in the classroom, like at Ogallala Lakota College, where I used to teach art. Yeah. Students learn art making practices there. The Ogallala Lakota Art Space in Kyle, South Dakota, also hosts classes and community workshops. So it's a diversity of places, and it's really something that, you know, I try to be in practice with and encourage and pitch in how and when I can.
Yeah. How do you inspire the next generation in person, and then how might they be inspired in a gallery space?
I think in person it's just generosity. I mean, that's always been my philosophy, is like just to share, and, you know, if I know something, how to do something or use a tool, you know, being generous with that knowledge and, you know, mm-hmm. helping people achieve that stuff. And I think within the gallery space, that's a different context. It's a different way of looking at artwork and thinking about artwork. Oftentimes I feel like, you know, taking an artwork and putting in a space, and especially like an institution like the Journey Museum, you know, it changes the context of the work, and it gives people an opportunity to see it a little differently, maybe.
Okay.
I don't know if that makes sense.
Well, say more about it, because I'm also thinking about the work in relation to the work that's next to it as well. So it's the space, but then it's also how it relates to the other artists in the room and what they've brought.
Oh, yeah, definitely. And yeah. I spent a lot of time thinking about placement and going round and round. There was a long period in that curatorial process deciding how to juxtapose work and how to create, sometimes it's called passages of images,
okay.
you know, for people to look at and think about. And it's a little hard to just describe over the radio, but when you go into this exhibition, you know, one of the things that I wanted to do was to disrupt, I think, a lot of preconceived ideas people might have about Lakota art and show, you know, new processes, new themes, but also folks that are working, you know, differently in those mediums and, you know, choosing what to portray. You know, for instance, Keith Braveheart, yeah. who's a painter, you know, his paintings are of, you know, contemporary Lakota people, and many of the backdrops in this exhibition and his paintings are scenes from Rapid City. So if you live here, you'll recognize landmarks like, you know, bridges on the north side or Golden Corral or, you know, places like that. And it's a juxtaposition of, you know, that contemporary scenes along with sometimes traditional, sometimes contemporary Lakota people.
Yeah. So allow your, if you're a visitor, if you're a gallery visitor, allow for that disruption.
Yes.
To see, because this is, I'm an overthinker, Marty, I think, especially when it comes to art. And I like to come in and really think about things and go back and forth and spend a long period of time in a gallery space with each individual things. I've learned that's not how everybody likes to do it. Some people just, you know, like a less, you know, intellectual approach to the art, to just sort of experience and feel it. But it might start with the willingness to have any kind of notions that you have disrupted and be comfortable with that, I guess is what I'm saying. Am I off there?
No, definitely. I mean, it does take a lot of openness going into art exhibitions, especially those that are kind of designed to be a little more challenging, but it's important. And, you know, I really believe that going to see things in person is really an important part of the process.
Yeah, being in person. Tell me some of the artists that are included. You mentioned Keith Braveheart, some others?
Yeah, so we have Martin Redbear, Michaela Patton, Jada Gray Eagle, Ray Janice, Sheldon Starr, Zalia American Horse, Dora Red Owl, myself, Delana Uses Knife, and then we also have a really special piece by Richard Red Owl, who is a important artist from our community who passed away recently, and he and his grandson Ray Janice had worked on a collaboration together. So Ray was generous enough to share that work with us.
I did not know he had passed away. How recent is that?
I want to say the last couple months or so.
I'm sorry to hear that. Incredibly important artist. So photography then, and mixed in with so tell me about the different kinds of things that people might experience as far as, you know, media is concerned.
Yeah, no, definitely. There's one photograph, and it's a really special photograph by Jada Gray Eagle. Yeah. It's a cyanotype on a shawl, like a traditional fancy dancer style shawl with the fringe. And she used this alternative photo process called cyanotype, which is one of the oldest forms of photography, and it's a light sensitive emulsion process. There's a photograph of her, and then you see some other silhouettes of plants and things all in blue on this white shawl. It's really a beautiful piece, and
I love her
grateful
work.
Grateful to have.
I love her work, yeah. So when you're putting all these together and you're making these decisions, are you thinking about the people who made the work, or are you thinking about the work itself? Do you try to separate them from the artist, or is the artist always a part of that? When you're putting them next to each other in a gallery, what's going through your mind?
It's a little bit of both. You know, I try to engage with the work on its own, and if it's strong enough work, it should, you know, be able to kind of exist within itself. But, you know, there's also important context included with the maker. And that was something when I was putting this show together that I considered, you know, really wanting to have a diversity of voices as much as I could. Okay. So differences in age, perspectives, different genders, gender identities, where people were living. You know, these are all Lakota people, but, you know, we have folks in the show from as far away as Pennsylvania, you know, and as near as Pine Ridge. So I really wanted that diversity.
If you could, we mentioned there are limitations to funding and resources, but if you could tour this exhibition across the country, what do you think the value would be in the art world if more and more people could see this particular collection?
I think it's really a unique kind of peek into contemporary Lakota culture, and there aren't a lot of places, you know, in this country that have space for that. Mm. I think there is space for some of these, you know, kind of different approaches. And again, kind of going back to some of the stereotypes around art making that comes from my community. You know, there are like Western art museums that, you know, that they like, you know, images of, you know, Indians on horseback and things like that. And they like that kind of, I'm using air quotes here, you can't see me, but traditional artwork.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's not entirely who we are as a people, and that's not entirely what our contemporary culture looks like. Yeah. And I think sharing that diversity helps, like, bridge understanding between communities. So when we stop just kind of being perceived as one thing, I think there's a lot of value there.
So what's your advice to the next generation of Lakota artists who might come to this and be inspired and hope that someday, you know, they will be selected to be in an exhibit like this?
I always tell, especially my students, you know, that their voices are important, that their ideas are important, and that what they make is of value. Mm. And even if in the moment it doesn't feel that way, or somebody's telling you that that's not the case, what they're doing is really important, because art is a critical part of every culture, and especially ours, and artists are really an important piece to all that.
That's Marty Tubbles Jr. He is curator of Lakota Contemporary. It's an intergenerational survey of contemporary Lakota art, and it is on display now at the Journey Museum. We'll hear from another South Dakota artist up next. Aaron Castle is after the break. We'll talk about art, fair trade, and getting to know your farmer, even if your farmer is half a world away. You're in the moment on listener-supported SDPB. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. When a wall becomes a window into someone else's story, art has done its work. An expansive new mural greets shoppers and passersby at the Sioux Falls Food Co-op on Minnesota Avenue in Sioux Falls. The piece comes from Sioux Falls-based artist Aaron Castle in partnership with Fair Trade America. She stopped by SDPB Sioux Falls Studios to talk about her creative process and why public art matters in connecting food, commerce, community, and culture. This morning I stopped by the food co-op off of Minnesota Avenue in Sioux Falls, and I saw your beautiful mural. It's been going up for a while. Once I came by, it was covered with a large cloth covering. I didn't know if that was weather-related or if it was surprise-related.
Surprise.
Okay. But now it has been unveiled.
Yes, it has.
Tell me a little bit of the story behind this mural on the wall of a small business in Sioux Falls.
Yeah. So I got an email sometime in August, and at first I wasn't sure what it was all about, but I decided to click on it. And sometimes they're questionable, but I'm really glad I did, because this wonderful gal named Madavi from Fair Trade America had reached out and said that my friend Becky from the food co-op had recommended me as a potential artist for a mural that they were looking to have done. And just that I had a special skill in painting faces, and that they thought I might be interested, and if I was, that I should submit some of my artwork. And, you know, they kind of gave me the timeline, which was pretty tight. So I was a little bit concerned, but I thought, you know what? Like, this sounds really interesting. They said that they were working with Ben & Jerry's, and I thought, oh, I really love this brand. I love their ice cream. I love what they represent. And I learned a little bit more about Fair Trade America and what they do for farmers, and I thought that was really special too. So I thought, well, what the hell, I'll give it a shot. So I sent him a whole bunch of images of some paintings that I had done, and I've kind of focused on portrait painting for many years, and so I thought, okay, I'll send some of these over. And I hadn't done a mural in about 15 years, and I had done one before that at the Last Stop CD shop here in Sioux Falls on the east side. So I was like, okay, well, let's see what we could do. And had him send me the dimensions. Actually, I went and took the dimensions myself, because I lived about six blocks from the place. So I thought, well, this is actually pretty convenient for me. And I already went to the co-op pretty often and knew a lot of people that worked there and were dear friends of mine. So I thought, well, this is really awesome. And so I knew that there was some competition, though, that they had already asked a few other artists, and that there were other people that had submitted their work. So I thought, well, I'll give it a shot. So they ended up liking it, and I had a couple different interviews where they talked to me about what I had done and, you know, what I thought I could do for a timeline. And, you know, that they would need it done by the end of September. And of course, I was planning a trip to London. I was leaving on September 12th and coming back on the 22nd. So I was like, oh gosh, that's going to be pretty tight. But I thought, all right, maybe I could take a couple PTO days, you know, work a few 8, 9, 10 hour days out there. And yeah, long story short, they decided to hire me. They gave me a couple images of Miss Marie, who is the focus of the painting.
She's a farmer.
Yes.
Yes.
So she's
Marie's a farmer.
Yep. Marie is a vanilla bean farmer, and she is from Madagascar.
Yeah.
And her story is so cool in that, like, she's she and her family work in Madagascar, and it's one of the only places in the world that cultivates vanilla beans. And it's a pretty fine practice. And so Ben and Jerry's has kind of an incubator program that they teach her and her community how to farm them. And so that program allows her to teach that to her community. And it just provides a living wage and allows her to have a sustainable lifestyle and take responsibility for that. And they just do an amazing job. And they wanted to elevate her.
Do you have any communication with her? And has she seen the mural? Like, help us understand, when you're painting a real person from Madagascar, who may or may not know where South Dakota is.
I've thought about this at length. So I've not gotten to speak with her directly personally yet. I do hope that I do have that experience with her. But I know that the Fairtrade America community has had many conversations with her throughout the process. I don't know at this point if they have shared the image with her, but she knows that this is happening. It's so incredible to think about somewhere across the world, somewhere she'll maybe never go in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, that her face is 16 feet tall on a brick wall, elevating her as this queen of the vanilla bean.
It's beautiful.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, you know, you go there and you get to see Miss Marie.
Yeah, so I...
Which makes us think where our food comes from.
Exactly.
Even in ice cream.
And that is really the point. That's what Fairtrade really wanted, was to... you know, elevate her face, make it so that people really see what goes into the work, who is doing this for us. You know, we wanted to make sure that the plant life, the illustration, the work around her face, and that it was all indigenous to the location. So in the painting, there's, of course, the vanilla bean flowers, the beans, all the plant life. There's a landscape of Madagascar, which is such an incredible you know, a wild place. And so I made sure that all the foliage and things like that that I incorporated into the mural were specifically from that location.
In your study of portraiture, what draws you to the human face? What makes you want to capture that in art?
Oh, gosh. You know, Marie in particular, I just love the pride that she wears in her smile, and that she wears her age with total pride too. You know, she, I wanted to make sure that you see the, you know, we see the age in her face, but not in a way that makes her seem, you know, old or haggard or anything like that.
Diminished, not
diminished, but, hardworking, taking pride in the things that she's doing. You know, she's sharing her life's work with the world and her family, and she absolutely takes pride in what she does. She's out in the sun. She's got a scarf on her head. She's out there sweating. You know, her shirt's a little open at the top, and you can just see that, like, she's been out there all day. But, like, it is the pride of her life that she's doing this herself, and she's doing it with the knowledge that she's gained And then she's sharing it with the people around her, and they're able to sustain that livelihood that way.
What did people say to you as you're putting the mural up, as you're doing the work of painting? Surely there are passersby.
Oh, yes. Yeah. I actually loved that so much.
The community.
As distracting as it could be sometimes, I absolutely loved the experience of being out in front of the co-op because, one, I had no idea how many friends I had that already shopped at the co-op, but also that, like, people that just drove by that came over because they saw that something was happening on the wall. And so they wanted to know who she was. Why was I painting her face? Why was she important? And, you know, I think that's what's so special about community and, working with the co-op on this whole process. That's kind of how this all came to be, too, is because, like so many of us, we work and live in this community and we elevate each other. You know, we find ways to connect and share our knowledge and share the things that we love and we know how to connect with each other and lift each other up in those ways. And so when people come up and talk to me about that, I feel like it invited people into the store. It invited people into, connect inside. And I think, again, like Ben & Jerry's, for example, is a brand that people know. It's something that you can get at any store or any regular grocery store. But the co-op, they do so much to be sustainable, to share organic foods. And so this was just a way to make that connection with others. So it's just very approachable.
Yeah.
And so I just felt like I was kind of that liaison. And I know for a fact that I had multiple people that told me that they gained membership to the co-op from seeing this face and then entering inside and seeing what else they had to offer. I spent a lot of time outside and then inside, and I had a lot of time having lunches out on that little side patio that's just beautiful.
Yeah.
And they really made sure that I was feeling good and safe and, you know, taken care of. I had a lot of friends that dropped by and bought me snacks inside. It was just a really wonderful community experience.
So where your food comes from matters, but also where your art comes from matters.
I think so. It really, I just really appreciated the experience. I felt very loved and taken care of. And I think that they very much care about where their food comes from. I know they work with a lot of local farmers.
Mm-hmm.
And again, Fair Trade America did so much to elevate her face, and they're doing that across the entire country.
Yeah.
I think ours was maybe the 17th mural that's been put up in the last 6 years. And so this program is going all over the place, and they're doing this in, some more rural cities. So not just Chicago, New York, that kind of thing. It's in
Coralville, Iowa, Richmond, Virginia.
Yes.
There's a whole list. Yeah.
Yeah.
Part of Fair Trade America's annual Fair Trade Month campaign. Erin Castle, thank you so much. It was a delight to see it come together.
Thank you so much.
It's always great to see your work out in the world. That's Sioux Falls artist Erin Castle. You can find her new mural at the Sioux Falls Food Co-op on Minnesota Avenue in Sioux Falls. And that is our show for today. We hope that it served you. In the Moment is produced by Ari Youngeman and Ellen Kester. I'm your host, Lori Walsh. From all of us here at SDPB, thanks for listening.